Hey, everybody. What's up? This is Seth back with TFOS, the Executive Function Online Summit. And I'm here today with Dr. Mark Burton. We were just doing the pre-interview. I'm super excited to talk to him because I feel like he's going to fill in a lot of gaps that were not filled in by other speakers and helping us understand some things with executive function developmentally, some things with ADHD and the connection, and some things with mindfulness and why that's so important. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing today?
I'm super excited. As you know, I told you that. So do you have any, let me do a quick intro. So Dr. Mark Burton is a doctor of developmental pediatrics from New York and has done a lot with ADHD, autism, learning disabilities, and a lot with mindfulness and really focuses on that. So we'll do a little bit more of an intro, but what do you hope people walk out of today with?
Well, I think there's value, I think, overall to understanding just what executive function is as a developmental path. So I think one thing we can certainly cover is it's a really useful way for any of us working with kids to just, I think, simplify our thinking quite often. I feel like it's a very scientific sounding word that really should be practical to parents, you know, yes. Just really make it useful. And then, you know, the second piece it sounds like we want to cover is that ADHD is very closely related to that developmental path. So we can go over that some, and then kind of tying it all together. It's almost the way I often like my thumbnail for the research around ADHD and the research around mindfulness is really they're almost two sides of the same coin. You know, one showing the value of building skills that help with resilience in these ways, and one showing the impact of when kids are behind in those skills. So I think a lot to cover, but I think we can touch on all of that.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, I like how you say I've never thought of it as the opposite side of the same coin, but I'm going to dive into that concept in a bit because I think that makes a lot of sense to my brain. Tell us a little bit about who you are personally, just outside of work.
Outside of work. That's an interesting question. I'm not sure where you want me to go with that.
Concerts before.
Yeah. I am a longtime music fan. I played a lot of sports my whole life. Pretty much. I do a ton of reading still, have a family, get outdoors as often as I can. I'm not sure what you want to.
That's great.
Touch on, but yeah. So that's. I have a lot of stuff I like doing outside of the office. So for sure.
Cool. Any good book recommendations for parents?
There's two. You mean fiction, nonfiction? I don't know.
First
I'm
not thing.
Gonna go there. There's too many.
Cool.
There's a couple of great books by someone named Peter Heller recently. A friend of mine named Lauren Akampura wrote a great book recently that. That people have been reading, but I could talk books the whole rest of the hour. So,
all right. So let's dive into your professional background. What do parents need to know about your professional background?
I'm in a field called developmental pediatrics, which isn't that well known, but it's actually a subspecialty of general pediatrics. So I practiced as a general pediatrician for around 5 years. And then I've always had an interest in child development, really going back to high school. And went back for fellowship training. And now really my day-to-day clinical practice is all about my full title is developmental behavioral pediatrics. And that's really what I do day-to-day.
And what does that mean?
It's working with, it's almost overlaps a lot with psychology. So it's working a lot with evaluating and supporting kids and families, managing children who are struggling behaviorally, struggling in school, like you mentioned at the beginning, working with a lot of families with ADHD and autism and learning disabilities and just, you know, whatever they need and supporting things at home, around school plans. And then I guess the other thing professionally that you touched on at the beginning is, and I guess it does tie back to my own, you know, my own background that you mentioned is that I was pretty fortunate that sort of before it became kind of headline news, somebody introduced me to mindfulness. So I was practicing for a while on my own. And then as I kind of watched the science take off and it sort of became clear to me working with families that everyone would benefit from the practice. So obviously it's not, it's personal choice for anybody I work with, whether they wanted to do it or not. But I find it really supportive in helping with just managing kind of the challenging situations that come up in families quite often. So I've been integrating mindfulness into, clinical medicine for quite a while too.
And what's the story behind how you got into this and why this matters to you?
Which piece of it?
Why developmental pediatrics and working with families and helping kids matters to you?
Honestly, I grew up immersed in it. I just think there's, my whole family's in special education. And then when I was going through the challenges I was going through in high school, one of the things that I found, incredibly important and grounding was I started working at Special Olympics and worked there for many years. And so it's really, goes back a long way for me.
And as far as executive function, we'll start sort of transitioning into that. Yeah. How do you define executive function in like one sentence? And then how do you expand that for parents?
I think the short version is just recognizing that executive function is basically the skills that act as the brain manager. So they're the skills we use to coordinate and plan everything, more or less. And that's kind of like the shorthand version of it. The broader way of looking at it is something I think that is intuitive when you pause to kind of reflect on it, that kids, gradually over childhood develop this sort of capacity to manage their own lives. And when you think about it that way, it's much broader than attention and behavior. It's attention and behavior initially. And then it's things like organizing and planning and managing your emotions. It's almost like the real shorthand sometimes I give parents when I'm working with ADHD, is you can look at executive function and almost anything you can put the word manage to in life probably has to do with executive function. You have to manage your attention, you have to manage your behavior, you have to manage projects, you have to manage your emotions, like I mentioned, you have to manage your day-to-day health. I mean, it's just an endless list of things because it's the part of the brain that sort of evolved to coordinate and supervise everything. And it's kind of, one way I sometimes sum it up in terms of a developmental path is, you can look at really young children, really, really young, like early elementary school, and probably with a lot of prompting, they could tell you like all the facts that go into something like running a restaurant, but you clearly couldn't put obviously you would never put someone in charge of actually doing that. They factually can list the stuff, but they couldn't do anything related to it. And then if you go out another 10 years into teenagedom, a lot of teenagers probably can get a meal on the table. They definitely know some of the more of the details of what it would take to run a restaurant, but still, most teenagers, you're not going to put in charge of like running something as complex as a restaurant. And then it's an important illustration because this developmental path of executive function matures until your mid to late 20s. And that's why if you go out another 10 years from there, certainly we all know people who, by the time they're in their 20s, they have serious jobs. They're, some people might be, managing a kitchen or managing a restaurant or doing something like that by the time they hit their mid 20s. And that's that sort of difference between what are the facts, obviously I'm speaking in broad strokes. The early elementary school kids are going to miss some of the facts, but they know a lot of it. You need food, you need to cook it, and you need, people, staff, and they could list all of that, but they don't have any, practically speaking, executive function skills to do any of that or make it happen. And then the other thing we might touch on today is that really big difference between, that same equally large developmental step happens between 15 and 25. You couldn't expect most 15-year-olds to do that either for the same reason. Executive function hasn't matured and is a long way from maturing.
So when we start looking at ADHD and executive function and people, I'm sure you get a lot of parents saying, actually one question that I have, I see the term executive function disorder.
Right.
And how do you sort of break that down for people? And
I don't personally find the concept of executive function disorder particularly useful. On a practical level, the way to look at ADHD is it's a developmental delay of executive function. I mean, that's the most useful way for people to look at it, forgetting all the nuances and the reason, why they...
I love that.
Just like skip everything else for now. I mean, there's some academic debate over it and everything else, but practically day to day, ADHD is... There's two parts to ADHD that are worth knowing. I mean, worth to sort of summarize. There's lots worth knowing, but to summarize it, which is... practically, there's a wide range of typical development. So part of looking at whether someone might have ADHD is just sort of evaluating for someone this age are, you know, are their executive function skills, you know, far behind what we would expect? And there's a judgment call. There's no really perfect test for ADHD. It's all clinical medicine. And then the single most important thing, I mean, the one way to sort of separate boys will be boys or, you know, kids will be kids from ADHD is that it has to be so far significantly behind that you're causing yourself chronic difficulty in some way. And really, as long as you're in the range of typical development, you shouldn't be causing yourself, you know, like chronic significant issues. And that's really the most straightforward way, I think, of summarizing, you know, what it takes to sort out who has ADHD or not. Sure, kids will be kids. And, you know, if you're just in the range of, you know, what's typical, you shouldn't be chronically causing yourself learning issues or chronically causing yourself social issues or, you know, whatever else it is. It gets much more nuanced. And, you know, when you get older, it's often health issues that you're talking about. I mean, so it's different at different ages, but they shouldn't, that's the basic way to separate it to me.
And then to me, for parents, that sort of brings my brain at least to the question of what about then overdiagnosis, underdiagnosis, or misdiagnosis?
Well, I mean,
it's not always chronic, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a very nuanced question. And I think, you know, there's several points to touch on. First of all, from a big overview of the field, there's actually statistically just about as much underdiagnosis as there is overdiagnosis. So the problem is actually much more complex. So misbehaving boys get overdiagnosed with ADHD, you know, and that's been shown in particular. And there's parts of the country, you know, where the stats are, you know, way off. The flip side is that well-behaved kids for whom school comes easily are actually chronically underdiagnosed when they still may be struggling with ADHD. And the, you know, the actual rate of ADHD is roughly 1 in 15, you know, across demographics and around the world, in spite of the headlines, in spite of best-selling books and everything else. When you actually look at it, that's pretty consistently shown, you know, plus or minus a little bit. So that means that you actually have problems skewing both ways, you know, and one of the things I think that is not talked about enough is if you have a community that's overdiagnosing ADHD, what's the impact of that on the 1 in 15 kids who actually do have it? Mm. Because their parents might be slow to seek out a diagnosis, but because the community is, you know, because their experience of it's bad, you know, that it's being overdiagnosed and there's a lot of judgment involved in it. And there's a lot of, you know, perception of like, oh, everybody has ADHD now, or everyone's getting the, you know, it's like this whole mess of things that really actually complicates life for the fact that, you know, in the middle of all the overdiagnosis in that community, 1 out of 15 kids still actually do have it.
So then that sort of brings us back to, I really like the way you communicate. You have a very good way, by the way, of bringing things to the important parts of content.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. So when we have younger kids mm-hmm. who are struggling with executive function, mm-hmm. it may or may not be interfering to that that much, or may not seem to be interfering with the things we're valuing. Mm-hmm. How do we know? How do we sort of see red flags when they're not very big for families who have younger kids?
That's a great question, and I think I think there's probably two parts to that answer. You know, one is, and they're related. I mean, the way to see where there might be an issue has to do with, you know, understanding child development in a way where we can sort of see where someone is. It's that same concept of just struggling in some way chronically, you know, separate mm-hmm. from a label. I mean, we haven't touched so much on the fact that like any parent can benefit from understanding executive function, because I think some of the struggles we have nationwide are from, you know, schools, for example, just totally not always understanding executive function, like what kids should be capable of at different age. Like there's some research showing that kindergartners in particular get misdiagnosed with ADHD when kindergarten is overly academic. You know, it's just a misunderstanding of what kindergartners are supposed to do. So some of it is in a, you know,
exactly. Very well put.
Ties back to, you know, it's so hard as a parent. I mean, it's so pressured, and you know, it's like, it's hard. I mean, you know, and we don't, you know, it's emotionally charged for us as parents to sort of just objectively look and say, you know, somebody might benefit on working on this, you know? And so the first red flags are going to be developmental, in that executive function in very early childhood does have a lot to do with just attention and behavior, not a lot of the other nuances of executive function. So in early childhood, it's going to have a lot of things to do, like focusing for age-expected play and navigating social situations, and, you know, maybe in the, you know, just being able to do, you know, managing your behavior through a typical preschool. You know, so it has a lot to do with just, are you chronically getting in your own way in those age-appropriate activities? As you get older, it becomes, you know, the most subtle types, mild symptoms of ADHD sometimes don't even show up till college. You know, when for the first time you're supposed to be fully independent and you don't have the managerial level skills to coordinate and navigate that. And I do think a related concept to all of this, which I think is important to separate out, is that we've sort of, I think, artificially conflated the diagnosis of ADHD with the medication. You know, and it's not that at all. I mean, the initial evaluation understanding of ADHD is just information. It's just understanding what's going on for a child. You know, you don't, and there's, and especially in younger children, but really across the lifespan, there's a lot of non-medical intervention that can help a ton. And it's, so you don't want to, you know, there's no point being afraid of exploring it, because it's just information initially, and it's valuable. I see things change a lot just when parents understand what's going on before we even start intervening.
And what when families come to you, what are some of the biggest, one or two of the biggest misunderstandings they always, you always hear in your practice?
Well, I think ADHD as a whole, like, it's much more instinctual to understand, for example, like language development language delays as being part of development. You know, so that if a child is behind in language, you know, no one's happy about it, and you do an intervention trying to catch them up, and you speak differently to them for a while they're not understanding, but there's not as much judgment and blame and everything else to it. When it comes to executive function, it's so nuanced and not really how many of us were brought up to understand that things like persistence and motivation and impulse control and emotional reactivity are cognitive skills that children are, who are behind in those skills, get labeled as being difficult or unmotivated or a whole host of other things that are part of their delay. And it doesn't mean they're off the hook. Part of how children learn is through discipline. They still might get in trouble, but it is a major shift to just take the judgment out of it. Like, to recognize that, you know, you still have to get in trouble if you impulsively, you know, did something inappropriate. But it's also not exactly your fault either. You know, it's not that you could have done better. Then it becomes even more complicated sometimes, because when kids are behind, it's not an absence of skills, which, you know, it's an inconsistency of skills. So they're going to get it right some days and not get it right other days. And that leads to kind of this false perception, like, if you can do it Monday, why can't you do it Tuesday?
But or if you can do it with something that you enjoy, why can't you do it with...
Exactly. Totally. That's a perfect one. Exactly. That's a great example. I mean, that's another major issue with ADHD diagnosis, is that, just like you said, if you enjoy it and it's easy, it doesn't put demands on the brain, you might be able to focus on it perfectly. So everybody with ADHD pretty much can focus on one or two things, you know, they're just totally in their wheelhouse. And that doesn't mean they can focus on everything else. It just means that those things are kind of effortless to them.
Yeah, and I talk about that a lot, because it's so important to make that distinction, because what I see, similar to what you see, is I see it in terms of shaming messages, in that you're lazy, or you're not motivated, or you're not disciplined, or you're not trying hard enough if you would just apply yourself.
Right.
That's a total misunderstanding of what's going on.
Right. And for somebody, you know, for somebody who's struggling, one of the best one-line descriptions that I probably overuse of ADHD is, it's not a disorder of not knowing what to do, it's a disorder of not doing what you know. That's Russell Barkley's famous quote. And what that really means is, if you keep pushing someone, you know, like you're saying, like, you got it, you can do this, you just need to, you know, work harder.
You do it before.
Yeah. You often create an internal stress and internal self-perception that's really being undermined, because in the end, they probably do know what they want to be doing, should be doing, could be capable of someday, but when they're behind in executive function skills, they just don't know what to do to accomplish it. You know, so, and then they just end up feeling worse about themselves often, even if they can't verbalize that, because they're actually skills that are behind.
And then that's when I see the kids in middle, high school, and college, that they've really internalized a lot of that. And a lot of my work is trying to help them reframe a lot of that messaging.
Right.
So before we get into some stuff about mindfulness, can you talk about the importance of trying to get the whole family involved?
Well, I mean, that's the premise of almost everything I do. There's no way to work.
Why is that so important to you?
Well, I mean, I think it's obviously important. I mean, first of all, even before we talk about, you know, resilience and ADHD and everything else, obviously that's the foundation of just about everything in childhood. And it's, you know, it's really a starting point for working with any family, is understanding the whole family. When it comes to ADHD, when you have, there's kind of two bullet points. On the one hand, from the parent side, when you have a child who is behind in the skills that help them be independent and successful, that is incredibly, you know, stressful and overwhelming and exhausting for parents. You know, so you have to acknowledge and work with that if you're going to help a family. And then the second side of it, which is inherently tied to that, is ADHD is a planning disorder. So if you have ADHD, you're behind in executive function skills, which are the skills you use to plan, which means that the plans you make to manage your own ADHD are undermined by having ADHD in the first place, which means that really all the way through high school, a lot of kids with ADHD rely on their parents to help create the routines that are going to help them overcome their ADHD. And, you know, and that's tough for teens. Adolescents don't always want that. That's a whole other discussion. And yet from a skills point of view, some people estimate if you have ADHD, you may be a third behind in your executive function skills. And it doesn't matter if you're 15, you know, in terms of, you know, you look old enough and you want to be independent, but if you're 5 years behind in your executive function skills, you're going to require a lot of supports from adults until you manage to, you know, build your own routines and catch up. So that, so that's the other side of it for a family. And then, so that the, you know, the kids rely on parents. And then the last thing, which we touched on, I think, in the introduction that we didn't come back to, is that ADHD is highly genetic to begin with. So you're, you know, the odds of a parent having ADHD, if a child has ADHD, or at least, you know, even if they've outgrown most of it, having some difficulty with executive function are quite high. So you have to acknowledge that and work with that too.
Yeah. And then obviously we both probably see both sides of the spectrum. A lot of times you have one parent who has exceptional executive function and one parent who doesn't.
Right.
And the misunderstandings that that creates are pretty tremendous.
Yes. That creates a lot of tension in marriages too, for sure.
One of the comments that I've heard many times when parents start learning about executive function is, I am my child's executive function.
Yes.
I think that's tied into what you're saying here. Exactly.
And that, but again, that, you know, that's exhausting. That's why I started teaching mindfulness to parents, is it's exhausting and stressful, which has a lot of, that has many implications. I know you want to talk about mindfulness, we can get into it, but I guess I'll start by saying, you know, when you're exhausted and overwhelmed and stressed as a parent, that makes it harder to do the rest of the intervention for ADHD. So it's no small thing. I mean, like, we're supposed to be tired as parents sometimes. And it's not that parenting is going to be so easy necessarily, but the better we manage whatever we're facing, it makes it easier to do all the rest of this. So I think, that's an important starting point for all of this. And I think there was a second side to your question, but I think I lost it there. So
no, this is good. So one of the things that many of the speakers have talked about is the patience with this, is that this is not a quick fix. It's not an overnight matter. This stuff takes time. And I think that that's exactly what you're talking about too, is that when parents are learning mindfulness, when the family's working together to try to create change, it takes a lot of time and patience and persistence and energy to do.
Right. And now I remember what you said. And it actually, you know, there's different ways you can look at something. It's like, yes, you are your child's brain manager quite often. That's real. But like you're saying, the premise of a lot of the interventions is it takes longer than other kids. But if you stick with that, you know, eventually your kids internalize it. So as exhausting as it is along the way, you're not typically, I mean, it's, you know, the art of it is doing it in a way that gives your child, you know, very slowly more responsibility over time. But you're not typically, I think there's a lot of fear that you're sort of creating a crutch that if you do it now, it's going to be this way forever. But that's not it at all. I mean, kids want to be independent. They're going to push back all through childhood. That's what they do. And they do it more as teens. So if you're acting as their brain manager in some way, you know, really, that's mostly just being supportive. It's helping create the structure that's going to let them thrive. And then you just got to keep an eye on it. And they will certainly tell you when they're ready to do it on their own. And you just have to be aware of whether that's true and then just give them opportunity and keep an eye on it. And, you know, over time, they'll become more independent. But when you're acting as their brain manager like that, as long as you're, you know, aware of the big picture and looking for opportunities to give them independence, you know, generally speaking, is usually just the positive.
And I think this starts to get into really complicated territory, because the question that the parents have then is, well, how much is too much support? Where is the point where I'm enabling? Where is the point where I'm doing too much? How much is too little? Because I'll often see, you probably do too, the pendulum swing where the parents just say, fine, you do everything. I'm not going to do anything. And then sure, for months, everything falls apart right, and then there are horrific consequences. And I want to lead into this idea of mindfulness with this. And then right, there's this idea of gradual release of responsibility.
I think
haven't heard of that. That's an interesting concept.
Yeah. I think often it's looked at, like, you know, often it's like you're trying to create a safe container and you're trying to say, like, you know, you're like, these are the boundaries I'm willing to work within as a parent. You know, I wish that there were more black and white, like, do it exactly this way type answers, but there can't be, you know, around parenting, and there can't be, you know, in child development. It's not about, you know, there's very specific things we know from an evidence-based point of view are more likely to be effective than others. But it's not like you have to, there's any one answer. It's all about knowing your own child and working with them. I think in general, children thrive on success, and that when they're behind in executive function initially, that tends to mean the adults creating a lot of structure. That's part one. And then you know, the way I typically look at it, and I always have different ways of thinking about it. I mean, one of the ways of thinking about it to me is almost like that moment when a child's learning to ride a bike and you have their handle on the seat and you're just holding it and holding it and holding it, and you just want to let go at that moment they think they're going to take off on their own. And that's a lot of what you have to do when you're working with executive function. You know, the way children learn skills, it relates to the science of habit formation. You know, it's going to require, the way I sometimes break it up is initially you're just making sure things get done. You know, just, we're going to, you know, this is, has to happen. Whatever, like you're going to hand in your homework, you know. And then what you need to try to do is you create that structure and you create that routine and you repeat it for a while. And then instead of just going from all to nothing, you tend to just need to back off a little bit. And you step back a little bit, and maybe now, you know, you're saying, like, okay, what do you need to do next? You know, or what, you know, you're sort of watching to make sure homework happens well, you know, with a lot of reminders initially of, you know, and then you step back from there and you're just sort of making sure, you know, and then you step back a little bit again. And, you know, so the goal is to sort of hand up the reins back over,
right,
you know, while recognizing that, as abstract as it can seem, forgetfulness is an ADHD symptom. You can't choose not to be forgetful. You can teach someone a way to overcome forgetfulness, and you just sort of in a gradual way do that. And of course, that, you know, as it probably sounds like as I'm describing it, that's a lot of work, but it does, you know, but it's effective.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this leads so perfectly into the mindfulness discussion, because I think this shows up in two big ways. One is that when the parents are mindful about the complexities of the situation, or start to learn to be, right, they can be making decisions about how they intervene more mindfully, more thoughtfully, with more awareness.
Right.
And then you also have the mindfulness with the executive function stuff, where I talk a lot about mindfulness or reflection or introspection or self-awareness,
right,
where the child is learning more and more about who they are as a learner and a thinker and an emotional being. They're becoming more mindful, and then they can interrupt their own patterns better and make choices more mindfully, thoughtfully.
Right.
And then what you said before, which I loved, was that it's sort of two sides of the same coin.
Right.
You sort of have this mindful, attentive, part where we're conscious of what we're doing, and then you have sort of the opposite, mindless or inattentive or unaware or not conscious of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And that really does fit so well in explaining it. So to get us sort of into that, tell us more about this mindfulness thing that a lot of people are associated with something woo-woo, which is not.
I mean, mindfulness has become this crazy thing in our culture right now, and a lot of people are dismissing it. And I think it's important to just cut through. One of the most important things, one of the things that connected me most with mindfulness years ago, is there's a very initial important teaching of basically, look for yourself to see, is it true? Like, if anything, like, don't take anything at face value. You know, ooh, go practice mindfulness. It's like, that doesn't mean anything. It's like, listen to what it means and then try it out and see if it actually works. But the actual premise of mindfulness is pretty straightforward. It's that life can be pretty unsettling, and we spend a lot of time kind of distracted and reactive and on our heels. And we're really looking to, without any expectation of being perfect at it, just work on some mental traits that help us navigate that differently. So, and mindfulness gets used lots of different ways. Traditionally, really, it has to do with kind of this idea of just seeing things. Sometimes it's called like unbiased awareness, just seeing things clearly. So when it comes to ADHD, for example, it can be that moment where you know, just recognize like, oh, all those behaviors aren't like someone being a pain in the, you know, whatever, they're poor executive function. You know, and if I'm going to manage ADHD well, I have to accept and see with clarity what it means and just let go of all my past expectations of what somebody should do at a particular age, or, you know, or that ADHD isn't real, and just let go of all of that. So, you know, the traditional view of mindfulness is that, and very specifically, it's a practice that, you know, if we practice that skill set, it improves over time. There's a concept in brain development called neuroplasticity, which just says that anything we do over and over again hardwires itself. So like, we can talk about, you know, the word mindful gets used lots of different ways. Certainly in life, you can aim for that, but the practice of mindfulness is really working on it. However, you know, it has much broader implications than just being like quiet or calm, which we can't all manage all the time anyway. It's really meant to be proactive, and that's the other important myth to sort of blow apart. It's not meant to be like, oh, it's all okay all the time. You know, the goal is to settle and see life clearly and then make choices and decisions. So, and even then, as I'm saying it, it's like, this is already getting too abstract. I mean, what it really means on a real life level to some degree, for example, around ADHD, is like, ADHD makes family life really, really stressful. You know, it often does. And then you go in to work on like, okay, here's a new behavioral technique to use. And if you're completely swamped and off balance and reactive and, you know, can't in that state of mind, of course, it's going to be hard to do something different, like work with Seth on some new plan that's at home. It's like, that's going to be harder if you're just so unsettled. So the basic premise of mindfulness is we can work on it like we would a gym program, of just staying a little more settled under stress, which helps us both see our choices more clearly and also, you know, make more active choices about how we manage different situations. And that leads to all sorts of other benefits.
So maybe we can start heading into the direction of, well, then how does a family do mindfulness or practice mindfulness or get started? And I don't want to go there quite yet, because I think something that's really important to address before is something I've heard so many times, particularly from people whose brains are just going.
Right.
I can't meditate or practice mindfulness because I can't stop thinking. That's not for me.
Okay. So, I mean, and that's a great starting point. So the whole premise of, I mean, everything, well, actually, I'll start with a very brief story. You know, many times when I teach mindfulness for ADHD, you know, classes for people with ADHD, there's a basic instruction when you start doing meditation instruction of something along the lines of, do your best to focus on what it feels like to be breathing. And I can talk about why we do that in just a moment, but the teaching is like, okay. And then when you do that, you'll notice almost immediately you get distracted and your mind goes somewhere else. So don't get frustrated and don't judge yourself for it. Just come back again to the next breath. And, you know, and the basic premise is, you know, if you manage to do that a few times over, you know, 10, 15 minutes, that's, you know, great job. You've done it. Even if it happens just three or four times, that's perfect. And somebody with ADHD almost inevitably will raise their hand and ask the question, you know, Dr. Burton, that instruction where you said, like, you're going to get distracted, don't worry about it, just come back. Is that something you use for everybody, or is that something you just use for the ADHD groups? And the answer is use it for everybody. You know, everybody has a busy mind. There's no premise to meditation that our mind's ever really going to be still. In fact, the premise is the opposite. If meditation were easy, no one would need to practice. Mm. The real premise is we're constantly having thoughts all the time. Some of them are perfectly practical and we got to act on them, but a lot of them are habitual or circular or random. And then we get caught up with them and running with them and, you know, just sort of escalate our lives in all sorts of different ways because we never see through that pattern. So the reason we focus on breathing is totally practical. It just happens to be right there. I mean, you really could choose anything that doesn't have a lot of emotional content to it. It's just, we're breathing. So you might as well focus on that. And that's the entirety of it. So there is no doing meditation well. There is no doing meditation poorly. It's totally fine if your mind remains busy. It's totally fine if you're restless. You know, we're working with real life when we practice meditation. And if it was easy, there'd be no point even practicing. Mm-hmm.
I did I've been meditating for a long time, and I started because of anxiety and panic attacks is how I got started in it. And a couple years ago, I did a 10-day silent retreat.
Sure.
And yeah. I don't think I stopped thinking the whole time.
No,
it got slower.
Yeah.
I mean, it really
changes. It changes kind of like, sometimes the way I think about it, it's like, you know, kicking the surface of a pool. You know, it's like, you know, if you kick slower, eventually the waves go slower. Everything just sort of slows down, but it's not like, you know, the thoughts stop completely. It just sort of changes the pacing of things. And, you know, thoughts lead to more thoughts. And when you stop, you know, getting caught up in that as much, it does slow things down. But yeah, they never stop. And if you talk to people who've been practicing really seriously for the, you know, most of their adult lives, they'll tell you the same thing. It's that we're relating to those. I mean, that's another nice summary of mindfulness I sometimes use and have heard is mindfulness is mostly a practice of looking at how we relate to things differently. You know, we can like you're saying about anxiety, you know, we can get caught up in those habitual patterns and thoughts and just get totally, you know, off on a, you know, on that train. Or we can begin to recognize like thoughts are thoughts and, you know, that's that pattern again. And then you come back to the next breath and you do that often enough and you sort of shift how you relate to that. And I say that very respectfully as someone who has some of those patterns, you know, I had the same benefits of a lot less anxiety over time, you know, through the practice of mindfulness. And then you also relate to what's going on in the world around you differently. You know, you can start to look at it like, oh, that's that pattern. That's what I always say around homework. And, you know, you just catch yourself and go, oh, you know, that never has worked before. So maybe I should just like pause a second here and try to do something different. But without effort, we just fall back in that same reactive cycle with our kids or with ourselves or everything else.
I just want to reiterate what you said, just in a slightly different way for the people watching. I talk about the pause button a lot. I feel like when we're not mindful, we don't really have a pause button.
Right.
And the more mindful we are, the more we're able to A, use the pause button, and B, the longer it is so that we can reflect on the decisions we're making.
So even, you know, I love blowing apart mindfulness cliches, like even the cliche about being in the moment, it's like, forget the words. That's the corniest thing ever. You know, it is just the simple reality that if we're going to make a different choice about anything we're doing in life, you know, like you're saying, we have to like catch ourselves and just create enough space that we can see what's actually going on and say like, oh, you know, I've always done that, but maybe I'm going to try this other thing a little bit now. But you can't do that if you're just caught up in, you know, no pause, no, you know, just reactivity, habit, you know, no attention to what's actually going on. You'll just always do the same thing over and over again.
So, and right before I ask a little bit more about how to start, I want to ask one more thing. And that is that you have a family who is trying to really work through some of their struggles. And they're still just not quite grasping the value of mindfulness, maybe on the relationship with their family and their kids, maybe on what it's really going to do for them. It is so abstract. Can you make the value a little more concrete before we go into?
Well, part of the reason is yes, with a caveat. So I would say that from a practical point of view, mindfulness is about just managing whatever's going on easier. And, you know, for any of us who are feeling stressed or overwhelmed about any situation, you know, from a research point of view, it's been shown to be a very practical way to just help manage that situation. And it helped. And so I think that's the simplest thing. I mean, it's practical and accessible and doable by anybody, and isn't, you know, you don't have to be anything in particular. It's just a way of like trying to build whatever traits you want that help you manage stuff easier. And, you know, if it helps with buy-in, it's important to know that one of the reasons I started including it in my medical practice is there's now like plenty of research, hundreds and hundreds of studies coming out a year showing that it has very concrete benefits around stress, anxiety, family. There's been physical changes in the brain shown, you know, around people who practice mindfulness regularly, beneficial changes even. So, you know, in the end, it's both, you know, really understandable and accessible if you look at what it really is. You know, it's just like, look, you know, it's just useful to help manage, you know, life can be challenging. Here are some things that help you stay settled. And the research backs it up too.
And can you tell us about one of the families you've worked with who have started to implement it and what?
Well, I think, you know, it's almost too broad to look at it that way to me.
Got it.
Because most of the time, it's much easier for adults to start practicing mindfulness than kids. And when parents start practicing mindfulness, it just becomes family-based mindfulness inherently. Plus, if you're going to teach your children mindfulness as an adult, you have to be, you know, I always describe it, it's like playing tennis. I mean, you don't have to be a tennis pro to teach your kids tennis, but you know more about tennis than they do. So most of the time when I'm talking about mindfulness for families, and I used to be even more stubborn about this years ago, you know, I really try and almost insist on working with parents first. And that makes a profound difference. I mean, the only thing as parents we directly, you know, or as people we directly impact in any situation is just our own, you know, what we choose to add or not add to any moment of it. You know, that's it. On some practical level, that's just the reality of it, as frustrating as it is. So in any situation, if you want to develop, you know, mindfulness, it just starts with you and your own practice. And that changes, you know, I would say for, especially with young kids, 75% of family mindfulness is, you know, just practice it yourselves. And then, and that can be, you know, just trying to carve out a few minutes for a daily practice, which is hard, but doable. And then, you know, the next layer of it, I can almost add a third layer. So I'll say three layers. I mean, the next layer of it is realizing that, you know, when we talk about mindfulness, we're not talking about any one thing. We're talking about a way of living. And there's many ways to just bring that into everyday life. I do a lot of work with you know, a wonderful clinician and speaker named Chris Willard. And he talks about how, like, some of the roots in his mindfulness practice that he remembers is, like, he went to a school where they would do a lot of just outdoor walks and talk about, you know, then teachers would prompt, like, listening to the sounds as they were walking and watching the clouds as they were walking. And, you know, in essence, that's building awareness in its own way. So the second layer of it is looking at, like, if this mindfulness stuff is important to you, you know, how is are you valuing whatever that is as a family? You know, one thing we haven't talked about yet is that mindfulness isn't meant to be a self-help kind of practice. The real implication is that if we build these skills in ourselves, it changes how we interact with everyone else around us. It influences others. It's really not meant to be really overly self-referential at all. It's really meant the premise is, you know, because we work on this stuff, we improve life around us and for everybody else. And that's, you know, so you can look at, you know, how are you treating other people in essence when you're with your kids, and all these things start adding up. You're like trying to show, you know, a skillful way of managing life in essence. And then when it comes to the kids, I think, you know, there's a famous book about mindfulness in kids called Planting Seeds. And I think that's really what you're talking about. I mean, you're trying to make it accessible to your kids and introduce the ideas to your kids when it comes up. And then, you know, and then there's small ways to start introducing. I mean, I think the easiest ways to start introducing mindfulness is to add a little practice maybe to bedtime. But the most important thing is making it natural and just making it make sense developmentally and translating it for your family. Because the moment you start saying to someone, like, you have to practice mindfulness, you're done. You know, they're never going to do it. They're not going to get much out of it. And it takes a lot of patience. But I think when it comes to shifting from your own practice as a parent to working with kids, you know, it's not something that I necessarily lead with a family when they come home with ADHD. It's not necessarily the most, you know, mindfulness is a long-term slow practice. It's not what's going to necessarily, I mean, you know, in some situations it might be helpful for helping people start feeling more settled initially, and that's fine. We begin there. And sometimes you want to jump in and do more of like the ADHD, you know, the evidence-based ADHD care first, quite often, because by getting some ADHD-related supports in place, you know, it creates the space so that you can come back around to like, now let's start with mindfulness. So there's no one way of doing it as much as just recognizing it has value. It doesn't really replace anything else in life. It just kind of supports everything.
So a mindfulness practice would be more where we're talking about sitting and yes. being mindful, or practicing mindfulness can be done anywhere.
Yes, yeah, it is. And although that's a nuanced thing to explore. I mean, sometimes we talk about informal mindfulness practices, which are really valuable. So like in families, you can try to give full attention to dinner, you know, and so you just catch yourself every time your mind's gone off somewhere else and just try to bring full attention to your kids. And certainly, you know, make sure you have a family practice of having no phones at the table and stuff like that. I mean, just make it all about family time. So those sorts of informal practices are great, and there's many ways to use them. And you know, it is important to recognize, and I think this is too common, that you can't just shrug off the meditation part. It's kind of like the difference between taking the stairs at work every day instead of the elevator and actually having an exercise or gym program. It's useful to take the stairs every day and it helps with fitness overall, but for most people, it's not, you know, if they really want to get in shape, it's not going to replace everything else. And as difficult as it can be to do and to remember, you know, meditation tends to have a specific role just because, you know, that's where you build the traits that are hopefully going to spill over into everyday life. It's not really even meant to be relaxing or peaceful. I mean, it often is, but it's really just meant to be the core of a practice that, it's almost like if you wanted to, you know, out of the blue to become like a piano mover, you know, you probably would want to, you know, hit the gym and build up your muscles first for a while before, you know, in real life, you started moving pianos, you know. And with mindfulness, it's like you practice mindfulness because it just gradually over time builds traits so that the next time something really challenging happens, they're already there and they're kind of familiar to you. It's not that, you know, oh, I had an awful day, so now I'm going to go meditate.
Right.
It's more just like you practice every day and eventually it just becomes familiar and part of life so that the next time you go through a difficult stress, you know, all those traits have kind of hardwired themselves. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. I'm absolutely in alignment with that. And when you're doing a workshop or a class or you're helping a family or a student start to get into a more formal practice,
yes.
How do we do that?
Well, there's the easy answer and the hard answer. I mean,
do the answer. If you had a magic wand and somebody's watching, they're like,
I mean, the easy answer is, you know, it's sort of that, like a lot of things in life, it's not that the concept is hard, it's the implementation that's hard. I mean, to get started with mindfulness, you just want to let go of any expectations and don't worry about it. Just do it. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. It's like, don't overthink it. There's a whole bunch of great apps and classes and books, and just practice every day and don't analyze it right away, because analyzing it right away would be like starting to train for a marathon and deciding after day three that you're not going to be able to run 26 miles. I mean, it doesn't matter what it's like at the beginning. It's the practice and you just do it. The challenge is in the implementation, and that is more about, you know, each of our own like own mental habits and stuff, and habits are hard to form and something gets in the way and you forget and it's hard and life is busy and all of that's true, you know, but underneath, so there's a lot of problem solving, you know, there's a lot we can talk about it, just like the science of habit formation, you know, but in the end, it just means being structured with yourself and committing to it and just making it happen. And that is it really in the end. It doesn't have to be anything more or less than that in terms of getting started.
Awesome. And any other tips about that you feel are important to, well, like, do we need a cushion on the ground? Or
no, I mean, well, those practicality. Yeah. So I have two things I want to follow up on, and I'll answer that question. And then a second thing, because I know we only have a little time left, is that on the one hand, you know, there's no, just drop all the concepts of what meditation should be. It doesn't matter, you know, so you don't have to have, I mean, you know, if it helps you to have a cushion, you know, there's lots of recommendations like that. They don't matter that much, you know, it's like just about doing whatever works. you know, within reason. I mean, sometimes you can, when I'm too general and saying whatever works for you, you know, you can get pretty out there. It's like, you got to do the practice. So you got to take it seriously, but it doesn't matter if you're sitting, lying down, you know, whether you have a cushion or not, none of that is that important. The one thing we haven't touched on in terms of mindfulness and ADHD and really life that's so important is that one of the core things you start working with in mindfulness for most people is that as you, and it relates directly to ADHD, is that as you start looking at thoughts, like you were suggested, and habit, you know, almost everybody begins to notice that there's a habitual pattern of some kind that's sometimes called the inner critic. And everyone relates to it in different ways. So we tend to have this perfectionistic, harsh voice that is very different than we would talk to anybody else. And if we start, and if that starts to sound flaky, just okay, but you know, find the reality in it for yourself. Because really most people can relate to it in some way or another. Sometimes we've sort of falsely, you know, we have this false impression that that inner heart, you know, that sort of inner criticism is our drive, even though really lots of research suggests that when we're sort of perfectionistic and abusive with ourselves like that, in the long run, it undermines our motivation and persistence. So because one of these core mindfulness practices is beginning to notice that and then shift our relationship with that inner voice, that habit, and really create some distance from it, in essence, to start. There's a body of research around something called self-compassion by a psychologist named Kristen Neff, who, again, forget that, you know, I always like the term can sound like whatever it is, but the reality is if we can begin to notice when we're being overly harsh on ourselves and just shift our perspective to more like we would treat our closest friend.
Yep.
Not better or worse. You know, it's not that it's all good. It's not that we're not going to work on stuff. But we're going to work on stuff like we would tell our best friend to work on it. Like, you're doing your best and yeah, you know, you should do something about this and work on it, but you know, but it's okay. When we make that mental shift, that increases our resilience, increases our ability to stick to new plans, increases our capacity to think flexibly. So when we come back around to ADHD, like you were suggesting, there's a lot of internalization of struggles and failures and people telling you should be more motivated, and you start to believe those voices and you can't. There's a lot of this internal habit that weighs down making changes happen around ADHD. And one aspect of mindfulness practice is beginning to separate that out, to beginning to recognize, like, those are just thoughts, those are just habits, you know, whatever threads of reality there might be to needing to problem solve something, you know, that's important. But a lot of it is just like the weight of habit, and we can begin to practice and shift that so we don't get so bogged down by it, so that it frees us up to do everything else we need to do. Awesome. And that's an important part of how all this ties together.
Yeah. The inner critic piece is so big. When I started, I really was like, why are you so anxious? This doesn't make sense. You know, and I'd be hard on myself about it, but it shifted to where I could look at it and go, oh, that's an interesting anxiety thought.
Right.
Oh, that's an interesting fear. And I'm more watching it. Forget the word you used before, but more objectively watching.
Yeah.
Noticing.
Yeah, noticing.
Rather than being like, Seth, why do you have to think like that? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's perfectly said. Yeah.
And our kids need that. And parents need that, because parents often come to me and are like, they don't feel like a good parent, or like they're doing it wrong.
I think that's the hard, I mean, you know, parenting is always going to be stressful and miserable. And that's not, I said that poorly. There are always going to be moments of stress and, you know, feeling bad about things in parenting, because we want everything to go so well that, you know, the parents generally are going to, most parents relate to those types of thoughts. And again, you can begin to relate to them differently. You know, you can begin to catch that, like, every parent has that type of thinking. And, you know, this is just, you know, so it's like you're saying, you don't have to judge yourself. It's natural that I'm having that moment of judging myself, but I also don't have to buy into it quite so much. You know, I can just sort of say, yep, and I did the best I could.
And so we'll start wrapping up. I got two questions for you to wrap up. Well, first of all, is there anything that you really wanted to add in before we...
No, I think we did a pretty good job covering stuff.
And what specific action can parents take this week to implement some of your teachings?
You're talking about the mindfulness part or the ADHD part?
I think anything. So what specific action, you know, if you have a parent who's watching this, right, who's just really worried and they're concerned about their kid who's struggling with executive function, what can they do this week to take some
steps? You know, I'll give you one point around executive function and one around mindfulness. So around executive function, separate from just, you know, seek an evaluation if you don't know. I mean, you're not supposed to know as a parent. And you don't have to do anything with that evaluation if you don't want to, but just find, you know, just sort, you know, that's a general thing. More specifically, I think sometimes what you can do, if you're, especially if you know someone has a child has ADHD, but even if you suspect it, is just look at any problem and as a mental exercise, problem solve it as if it's all skill-based, it's all executive function. Like that, and that's simple. Life is more complicated than that, but it can be a real major step to problem solving. Like, what if, you know, not getting out of the door, you know, we're fighting over getting out the door on time in the morning. You know, what if that all is executive function? How much of it is distractibility? How much of it is impulsiveness? How much it is poor organization and time management? How much it is being emotionally reactive and irritable in the morning? Whatever it is, just like, look, you know, find somebody, you know, I guess this conference will do it, but just in some way look at, this is what I understand about executive function. What if I just took all the emotion and judgment out of this moment and just problem solved it? Like, it's just executive function. You know, let's just, and that is a really practical way to problem solve differently, because that's what a lot of kids with ADHD need in any specific moment is, what are the skills that are behind and how can I approach this moment separate from everything else, just from skills? That's, so from the executive function point of view, that's what it means to me to really forget the term and just roll up your sleeves and really begin to understand what living with executive function is like day to day. And then I guess on the mindfulness side, we already touched on it. Around the mindfulness side, if you're interested in it, it's like, just do it. You know, you don't have to just jump in and do it. That's what I often start people with, just like a 30-day challenge. Like, don't analyze it. Don't think about it much. If you're curious, just practice for 30 days. You can manage anything for 30 days probably. So just do it, what is what I would say about the mindfulness part if you're interested. And then I have a mindfulness resource page on my website. There's all sorts of resources about people teaching classes and books and apps. And, you know, but as a start, just jump in, just go for it. You know, it's really, and then make it real for yourself, because it doesn't matter what anyone else says about it. It doesn't matter what all the stereotypes are or the cliches. It's all about what you make of it. And I almost guarantee that if you choose to, you'll find some value in it.
Awesome. That's so good. And I want to reiterate your executive function point, just to make it, to be objective about it, to see it as developmental, I think is part of what you're saying, right? To just say, imagine that for right now, this is 100% developmental, 100% executive function, 100% challenges, how it reframes it. And like you said, it takes the emotion out of it so that you can problem solve skill wise. Mm-hmm. And my very, very last question for the day is this. From your heart, straight to the parent who's watching, who's really concerned, what is the most important takeaway you hope people leave with right now?
I think the most important takeaway is that, you know, you can do it. All children can thrive. So if you're struggling with any of this, it's about just seeing it with as much clarity as you can and making the choices you need to make. And if you do that, you know, everyone's going to do just as well as they should. So I think that's really what it comes down to.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dr. Burton. I so appreciate your time and expertise, and thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care now.